Sport never leaves the national conversation for long, does it? Last week, racism in sport was at the heart of all the talk. And talk and sport are at the heart of many Indigenous communities too. It was this fusion that captivated my next guest, who thinks oral storytelling and what happens on the sports field are intimately entwined, but also that the history of celebrating Indigenous people in sport has a rather nasty underbelly. It can entrench subtypes, not end stereotypes, he says. Dr. Laurie Bamblett, Lawrence Bamblett, or Laurie, is a research fellow at the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies. He's a Koori man. He grew up on Wiradjuri country in the community of Arambi on the Lachlan River in New South Wales, home of the Arambi All Blacks, the oldest recorded Koori rugby league team, and he headed back to all this and to a deeper history in his new book, Our Stories Are Our Survival. Hey, welcome to Life Matters, Laurie.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you there in the Canberra studios. Take us to Arambi and your own story briefly of growing up there, leaving school at 16. I think you became aware of education of a different kind through listening to oral stories.
Yeah, I grew up. It was just part of everyday life, normal life for me. And that sort of appreciation of what I was getting didn't come until later when I was a young fellow. It was just something that I loved to be around. And I made a really simple choice, you know, school that I didn't like versus staying home and listening to these really talented and entertaining people tell the history of our community and our culture.
Yes, and so, and you make this point that you were part of a family that really loved education, but it wasn't what we necessarily cast as formal education.
No, well, they had some pretty bad experiences with mainstream schooling. But at home, people understood even the importance of education and English literacy. To them, well, they talk about that meant freedom. So when they went to school on the mission, they weren't being taught by qualified teachers. So they rejected that, and people in the homes, grandparents, parents, they took up responsibility for teaching their kids to read because they knew it was important. So they used phantom comics, they used newspapers. If somebody came to their house, they taught them to spell their name. So they took up responsibility for teaching kids, but they also taught that our history didn't start when Captain Cook arrived.
Yeah, I love your reference to phantom comics. Big hit in my childhood too, I have to say. I mean, what intrigued me is that some years after leaving school early, you were drawn to academic study, and particularly of your own community, and you wanted to document this thriving oral storytelling tradition. But there was another driver for you, and this was this sense of unease, in particular about the stories that get told about Aboriginal people and sport. What was that unease for you, Laurie?
Well, basically, it just didn't fit with what I knew. When I got to university as a mature age student, when we talked about Aboriginal communities, what people were saying didn't fit with what I grew up with. And I kept saying to people, that's not what it's like. That's not what I know. So,
how didn't it fit?
They were talking about us being victims and downtrodden and all these terrible things, that we didn't have self-esteem and pride, and you know, that couldn't be further from the truth. We're very confident, very, very proud people. That's what I grew up with. I grew up with all these stories of these women and men that I idolised and the things that they've achieved. From Arambi, for example, tiny little community, no more than 350 people at any one time, and we've already got two PhDs, one on the way. We've got a Harvard graduate.
Yeah.
People don't really understand that. But we have those achievements. They don't see that part of our life.
It was particularly what you describe as the straight line story being told about Aboriginal people and sport that really got your goat in this book.
Yes.
What is that straight line story? And just tease that out for us.
If I could use something that's happening at the moment, is whenever something, an incident happens with racism, there always seems to be denials. It doesn't take very long for it to come around to be a denial or attack on the person that makes the claim. And so then sports historians and our people, we feel like we have to defend that racism exists. And the evidence for that, generally, more often than I'd like it to be, is that we live in terrible places. So we can't win. We have to say we're victims and and downtrodden people in order to have people accept what, you know, what I think is obvious, that racism exists.
Well, it's part of it that is that there's this sort of sense that there are these sporting heroes in the Indigenous community as if that's an exception to the rule.
Yeah, or that we excel at sport because we're hungry and needy and that we want to escape terrible places.
Do you think that's how it really is, though? I mean, many people would see that as a story of, you know, the story of Indigenous sport as a story of success, but I guess it's that very framing of it that really frustrates you.
Yeah, the idea that it's a story of rags to riches, it is. You know, if you go into any Aboriginal community, I think you'll find people, there are so many people there that would have and could have, but they didn't want to leave their community. And I think one of the reasons why you see the numbers increasing in sports like rugby league now is expansion. Teams are moving closer to Aboriginal communities.
Yeah, you wanted to explore new ways, Laurie, of looking at Aboriginal people and sport, and you headed back home to do it. And I think your mum, Mavis, was a major contact point for drawing those sporting stories out from the storytellers in your community. Tell us about the Arambi All Blacks rugby team.
Yeah.
They were born in the early 1920s, weren't they? Why are they so emblematic of your argument here?
Yeah, well, I didn't go back. I never left. I stayed at home while I studied, and I commute to Canberra now. So
yeah, right, okay, I'm clear now.
My argument is the place is that good, I didn't want to leave.
Yeah. And you've got five kids there too, I think.
Yeah. So the All Blacks, why they're emblematic of the argument, is that people saw them and represented them in a way that suited them. So if they went to a town, for example, where there was an Aboriginal community, what I found was that people saw that as a threat. So they used really derogatory terms to describe them. And when they went to places where there wasn't an Aboriginal community, you didn't see that same threat, so they were a bit more respectful.
Mm.
Then in our community, they were heroes. They weren't victims. You know, there were some really racist things written about them.
Yeah, you went and looked at the old newspapers, didn't you, and found some absolutely stunning commentary about the success of the All Blacks. What sorts of things?
Well, I started document basing. I just wanted to check up on all these stories that I've been hearing, and I wanted to find out more about the team.
Mm.
And they use that really stereotype racist language. Whenever they played a white team, for example, they were teetotalers. The dark brigade from the mission were the opposite to that. There'd be a story about drinking on the mission, for example, that ran around the time that a game would happen. There was always a contrast between the heroic white people and these people from Dark Town, they called it. The Black Menace was another one that they used. So there's always that contrast between the way that people saw them. And on the flip side, in our community, they were seen as heroes. They weren't seen. They were seen as examples of moral and people with values.
Although, there you go. They were seen as heroes. So there's still that kind of hero worship going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What was interesting, though, is I gather when the All Blacks were really first wowing people, the local whitefella team, the Cowra Pioneers, altered their club rules to exclude Aboriginal people.
Yeah, that was interesting. There was no clearly defined colour line that was drawn and then broken, say, like you did in something like American baseball. So there wasn't a Jackie Robinson, but the colour line was drawn, but Aborigines were still allowed to play for Cowra at some stages. So it was on and off sort of thing. But yes, they did draw the colour line, say that they wouldn't play the Aboriginal team anymore.
Yeah, and then you also look at the history of bare knuckle fighting in the community, which there were tensions there too about that, how that was talked about publicly.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, in most cases, things that were from our culture were seen as negative or examples of breakdown or irresponsible behaviour or even uncivilised behaviour. Whereas the way bare-knuckle fighting, it's a form of safe conflict resolution in our community. It wasn't the wild brawl that people talked about. It was more ritual than fight. And that's the way that people that were brought together and made to live on this tiny little place manage their differences.
Is I think you spoke to Mavis and Sylvia, who talked about the fights up at the railway gates, and these were kind of written up as kind of violence you describe it as ritualised dispute management. Is that, does that come from those stories from the seniors?
Comes from the stories and a lifetime of observing, watching the fights, and just noticing that, you know, that there were certain things that, you know, nobody ever got hurt. There were always elders there. There were responsible people that ended the fight when it needed to be ended. So it wasn't, there was never, even in the stories or anything that I've seen in my life, nobody ever got hurt. Maybe, except for their pride, maybe.
Except for their pride. That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then there's the Murray family. And that's where you actually zero in on one particular amazing sporting family to further illustrate this kind of tension between the way in which Indigenous oral history storytelling has tells a story versus the way in which, you know, other histories decide to celebrate or not Indigenous achievement. Who were the Murrays?
The Murray family are one of the big families at Arambie. They were one of the traditional leader groups, and with intermarriage, most of us are related. But they were, Harry Murray was the bidja, we call it in our language, the leader. He was the person that really became a spokesman for the community, and people looked to him as a leader, him and his wife Jane. What I found with them was they were a really interesting example because they didn't fit the idea of these terrible blacks that had to be controlled. And because of their sporting success, their son Doolan, for example, was Kara's first real sporting idol. So people didn't believe that they couldn't handle their own affairs. Harry had his own business. He had a sheep droving business. You know, they were examples of what I call Wiradjuri excellence. They were hard workers. They had values, morals. They were community-minded people. Everything that you would see in civic leaders in any community. So they couldn't be disregarded as those blacks, those terrible blacks that we need to control. So what they did was they tried to attack their identity and say, well, they're Negroes, they're not Aborigines.
Wow. Wow. I mean, how did you see the Murray family being written up throughout history? And members of that family are still alive. I think you've met with Jim Murray.
Yeah, I'm actually related to Jim. His mother's a Bambla, yeah. And there are a lot of connections. We're a small community, a lot of connections there. And Jim's younger sisters launched the book for me and they've shared some of their stories. But, they were, all of those old people, they were how they told us who we are, what's important to us, what's important in our culture. They were the examples that were set. You know, every lesson that we had as young people on how to behave was usually about either the Murrays or one of those other families, those old people. You know, that's how we learnt. And we were expected to be like them.
Do you think there's a censorship, there's a sort of emphasis on the positive in these storytelling traditions and perhaps a censorship of the negative, though?
Oh, no, we hear it all. It's just that why I think straight line stories happen is that you don't have time. Like, I've had over 40 years, so I've heard everything and I've seen everything. But when it comes to writing and taking an oral history that, you know, is a 24/7 thing for your whole life, and putting it into a paper, you sort of necessarily have to leave stuff out. And I think that's why we always end up hearing and reading about negative stories, because that's what people want to address problems.
It's a brave thing to go back and study your own community, I reckon. And, I mean, just really briefly and finally, what about your five kids? I mean, they're the next generation. So in some sense, they're the keepers of the tradition.
Yeah, one of the things I use a lot is photographs. I have a large collection of photos and I grew up loving those, and my younger son, who's 6 now, he has his own little collection of photos, and he'll bring those photos out, and people that he's never met personally, my great uncles and Uncle Doolan, all these old people from the Murrays and Bamblett families, he'll bring out the photos and say to them, you know, teach me about Uncle Byrne, tell me about Uncle Toots, tell me about, so he wants to learn about them. So for me, that's probably the best thing that's happened, is that he's got that interest, that love that I grew up with.
And that's interesting that that's a collection of photos. So this isn't just about the oral tradition, isn't it? It's also this, now in this kind of digital era, it's the visual tradition.
Oh, yeah. The way I describe it is that our people read photos. Some people will read history books. Our people will take out a photo and read it to you.
Look, it's a complex investigation that you've done here, and I think we've given people a taste of it. Laurie, thank you very much for joining us on the program this morning.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. Dr. Lawrence Bamblett, he's a research fellow at the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, and he never left Arambi, as you'll hear. His book is Our Stories Are Our Survival, and it's published by Aboriginal Studies Press. We'll pop the details on the Life Matters webpage for you, abc.net.au/radionational/Life Matters. Coming up next, ancient traditions of another kind, food.